The informal sessions at Holden Village, and we want to carry through on that tradition here. This is your chance to get to know some of those who have been lecturing on the platform and have had that protection so far. But we'll try to remove all screens. We're being told to live on the boundary, and this is the chance. But okay, for dialogue, questions, comments, this isn't speech-making time, but it's just good conversational time, and maybe some substantive things come out of it as well. But since Dr. Brigeman must leave on the 1 o'clock, or leave at 1 o'clock, I guess, for the boat, we'll spend at least the first half hour, if there are questions and comments that come up, with him, and then we'll open it up to Professor Tielicke, too. All right. Yeah. I saw Bob first and John next. All right.
Dr. Brigeman, you talked about the
Walt. Walt is my name.
Walt.
That's mine too. Good.
All right. Either one of you can answer. You talked about the tension between life in the city and the scriptures and the kinds of concerns and troubling that causes you. Can you share with us some alternatives that you are really concretely taking in your own life that excite you, or some that you see other people that are taking that give you hope concretely as we try to live in the boundary? I mean,
well, that's an important question and a fair question. But I don't know that I can be much help about it, because these are new questions to me. They shouldn't be new questions to me, but they are new questions to me. Obviously, the question of how we disengage from consumerism is an agenda item in our family. I feel about these texts that I've been trying to talk about is that these are very new readings for me. And I don't yet know whether I have the courage to face those texts. I'd be glad for you to come at that, or other people. That may be the most important agenda for us to talk about.
I really feel the fragmentation that you're talking about, and you know, so that's my struggle too.
Yeah.
John?
Yes. Well, your the results of your exegesis is really powerful for me. And I don't think it's just that your delivery is intense or clever. There's something really gutsy about the way you work with the text. Could you just tell the truth now?
Is the evening already that late?
I don't care for no man. I don't want to set you up, but what exegetical method do you, if you have one, what do you do? You play with a text, do you pour over them? And if you would, I'd be interested to know what you do when you start with a text.
Well, I read it in Hebrew. Well, I don't find that the most helpful thing to do. I won't say that in the presence of my students. One of the luxuries that a teacher has who isn't preaching every Sunday is that you can play a long time with the same text. And I guess that's really what I do. I try to do form analysis and literary analysis and stuff like that, but that doesn't really carry me anywhere. And I'm in a bind as a teacher because I think it's important to teach students that stuff, but that isn't really what they need to know. I do a lot of just a free association of ideas. I work a lot with concordances. And as you all know by now that I am heavily engaged in Moltmann's kind of hermeneutical program that I guess is the kind of angle I take on texts. It gets me in a lot of trouble. I am not very careful or very precise about exegetical detail. One, because they don't interest me, and two, I don't find that that's where the payoffs are. And I'm sure you're aware that I've engaged in a lot of eisegesis. And, you know, if I get pressed about it, I'll back off from it, but I don't feel terribly embarrassed about it.
If it was good enough for a Deuteronomist, it ought to be
that's good. That's it, right. Yeah. kind of the focus of where my thinking is now is on Mark 5, and I've been with Mark 5 quite a while trying to work at the problem of insanity. And I guess what I try to do then is to go out from that text in a variety of directions. And I don't have any particular pressures on me, like next Sunday, to have to move somewhere to some other text until I just catch another text that seems more gripping than that. I don't think that's very helpful, but what I do want to say is that the tools of the historical critical method are terribly important to me, but they are most important in being important to get past them. And I'm sure you all discover that too. Yeah.
How is the individual Christian group, or the church, going to dodge the pitfall of being an unwitting partner of Marx or something in some of these changes?
Of Marx?
Well, so Marx you... or any liberation theology or socialism or central government, we got here, people.
Well, I would not...
One set of bureaucrats with another.
All right, I would not like liberation theology to be grouped with Marx and central government and socialism. I think that certainly liberation theology in Gutierrez and some of the Latin theologians sounds like a political program. And I think I understand why it does when it comes from people like that. But my understanding of liberation theology is that it is not primarily a political program, but it is a meditation upon what Moltmann calls the promissory character of God. That he is primarily a God who makes promises and keeps them. And Christian life is somehow having to live between the making of the promises and the keeping of the promises. And what the city most wants us to do is to give up on promises. Now, if your question is primarily a question about Marx, I don't know a lot about Marx, and Professor Tielecki can talk much more effectively about that. It seems to me that we have two kinds of things to learn, at least from Marx, and one is that there is no disinterested knowledge, that there is no disinterested preaching, that there's no disinterested liturgy, We're no disinterested in anything, and to be about the business of discovering our interest. And the other thing that seems important to me is that I discover how much, one, I am indeed an economic determinist, and two, how much I am an alienated man precisely because of that. Now, I suspect that I'm not answering your question at all. Peter Berger, in his last book, I think it's his last book, he writes them so fast, called The Pyramid of Sacrifice, tries to assess the relative values of capitalism and socialism. And it's kind of interesting, he calls that, he talks about the problem of pain, that the one system has valued political freedom and paid a terrible economic price, and the other system has valued economic gain and has paid a terrible political price. I just think that if it is true that the world no longer is divided into East and West, but it is divided really into North and South, into the northern haves and the southern have-nots, then it seems to me that the questions for theology, the questions between capitalism and socialism, are rather uninteresting questions. That the real questions have to do with how does the voice of the oppressed get heard by all of the managerial haves? And I don't know that I'm much interested in, personally, in the temptations of Marxism or socialism or anything like that as a Christian. Now, I am as an economic have. But as a Christian, it is the terrible scandal that the voice of God and the gift of God characteristically turns up among the have-nots. And I think that may be a base from which we do our theologizing that maybe doesn't face that question, but maybe suggests to us it's not the important question that we have to face. Now, if I've dodged your question too much, come back at it.
No, I don't think you've dodged it. I see we've got this problem of distribution, and I don't want the church to fall into some political trap or some trap along the way. I'd rather face it as a church, even if we're a voice that isn't. Do you understand?
Dr. Freeman, would you push a chair back a little bit?
I mean to be hiding.
They have a spotlight for you there.
Move back to the boundary. Question
on the right. Okay. I don't know about questions on the left.
I don't know if I stand on the left.
Turn around and look at the right.
I would like to ask maybe a more personal question to each of you. Is it possible you could just share with us briefly maybe the person or the book or writer or whoever it has been in your Christian life that has helped to shape your faith and your life in Christ the most? And I direct that to both of you, really.
Could I just keep having one with a destiny? Or would I, yeah, person with a Buch nennen, die da im Glauben am meisten beeinflusst hat?
The Bible.
Ja, also außer der Bibel einige Dichter, Goethes Faust und die griechischen Tragiker.
Apart from the Bible, also a few poets, namely the Greek tragedy and Goethe.
And what was the last, please?
Goethe. the German poet Wolfgang.
Mine's a very different kind of answer. I suppose it's my father. My father's been dead 5 years, and I am only now discovering who he is in my life. My father was a not very well educated pastor who only served small churches and earned little salaries and didn't have any skills about getting along with people. But as I have reflected on it, he was on the right side of every question in every community. Intuitively, he was on the right side of every question. And he had a he was a pastor, and he had a sense about ministry, about God's solidarity with the losers. Now, you know, he wouldn't have put it in that kind of language, and I feel so comfortable sitting here putting it in that language, but he did it. And the other person, I suppose, was my sociology teacher in college. I went to a very small school, so I did half my work from him. And he really wasn't a sociologist. He was a Christian tractist masquerading as a sociologist, in which he just had a passion about people and society. And I did not know until much later how I was being propagandized for the gospel.
If there's a possibility that the best way to know what's going on in the brickyard and the palace is to be there more than any professional prophets are, would you suggest that there are some new forms of ministry that the church might be looking at or into now that may help us better understand both those venues?
Well, if I hear your question, it is based on the assumption that the brickyard is somewhere other than where we are. And I understand that there is an element of truth in it, but it's not fully true. And so I want, first of all, to say we better face the brickyard as we meet it. Beyond that, I am only coming late to what you Lutherans have known for a very long time.
I have to be Presbyterian.
I invite you in my pilgrimage. That the task of disciplined exegesis in disciplined theology and the role of a teacher is a full-time job. Now, you know, I am not opposed to tent ministry and that kind of thing. I guess I think that in dialogical frameworks, there are plenty of ways for pastors to find out about how other people experience the brickyard, besides having to be everywhere with people. You know, I'm not opposed to that. I guess I'm really responding out of a question that you're not asking, and that is the legitimacy and the primacy of the ministerial office that I think has been compromised in very many places for the wrong reasons of people feeling that they weren't really where the action is unless they go do something else. Now, that may be an answer that's way off of target from what you're asking.
Well, that's part of what I'm asking, and I'm saying, no, we just read the Bible to learn what the brickyard is like, and
well, my judgment is, and I may be answering this too much as an ivory tower teacher, and I don't think of myself that way, but I think that we really have to read people who are in the behavioral sciences. I believe that the fundamental foundation of the brickyard has to do with method. And the people whom we minister many of them are not even sensitive to the methods that keep people in the brickyards. The methods of scientism and quantification and all of that kind of stuff. And I think we have to be paying attention to what the theologians of the behavioral sciences are saying. And that's the level at which the dialogue needs to take place, as well as our weary parishioners that are victimized by it. But simply talking to the victimized will not let us get into the place where the epistemological questions must be raised. I've learned a great deal from those of you that are in campus ministry. Know Kenneth Underwood's study on the Church, University, and Social Policy, in which he says the task of the campus minister is not to counsel students and it's not to lead causes, but it's to raise the epistemological question in the university. Now, what I want to suggest is that the university is not the only place where that question must be raised. It must be raised wherever God's people are. And I thought that's what Dr. Tielecki was saying about evangelical ethics, that the issue in evangelical ethics doesn't have to do with our conclusions about what we do, but it has to do with our epistemological premises. And the epistemological premises of the way the city is organized must be called into question. So Professor Tielecki talked about the emancipation of our rationality. That's it. And our reason is all co-opted, so we can't think anything differently. Am I talking about anything you're talking about? Yeah, even if I wasn't, I thought it was very interesting.
There are some writings about American civil religion, apart from Marty and Richard Hill. What you're talking about, is this basically American civil religion or against that? Or where do you see the difference in that as compared to the feelings of American civil religion?
Well, it is American civil religion, but I mean to be talking about... And I may not be using the right vocabulary. Some of you know more about that than I do, so speak up. The scientific methodology that has become an ideology. It's no longer a method, but it's an ideology. I have to talk about the things I know a little about, and I don't want to pick on it. But the hospital, for example, my wife has recently been in the hospital. And you know Paul Tournier's distinction between technical medicine and personal medicine. And the method of the hospital has screened out personal medicine. And it's all technical medicine. That's not an accident of bureaucracy. That's an ideological decision that the medical community has made about what's important to human life. It's wrong. We all know that's wrong. That's why we do what we do with our lives. So that's related to civil religion. I suppose, and that comes very close to what President Hardern was saying, that civil religion blesses the gods of progress. But underneath progress lies predictability, quantification, control. So civil religion is kind of a legitimization for that, if I understand what Bella is talking about. You see, the neat idea of progress contains some very heavy ideological decisions underneath it. And those are the ones I believe that we must smoke out. You want to go any further with that?
So living in the boundaries is speaking out against the civil religion.
Yeah. living on the boundary means being aware, and I'm into vocabulary and language that I don't know what it means, you know, is being aware that there is another rationality through which the world may be understood, which is exactly what Jesus did to the Pharisees and the other management people who had everything explained. And I want to mention 1 Corinthians 1 tomorrow, but I think there Paul means to critique the dominant rationality of the Greek world, that God chose what is foolish to confound the wise, that God chose what is weak to confound. Incredible! That God chose, what is it, those of lowly birth, to bring to naught the things that are. Now, civil religion believes that the things that are must be and will be. And what kind of a God do we bear witness to that he can bring those things to naught? That, you know, that's the most down-under question I can think about, that my whole frame of reason is called into question. I don't care, you know, whether Lyndon Johnson wants to quote the Bible or Richard Nixon refers to God. You know, that's one level of civil religion. But that's a cheap shot. You know, they got to do that. But way underneath that, the Watergate tapes are not an aberration. They are simply a visible manifestation of the values to which our public order is committed. That is, if you know enough, you have the right to shape it any way you want it, to make it come out the way you want it. So, you know, if all that stuff is in civil religion, then yes. See, I'm very interested, and I haven't carried out the dialectic, but I want you to know that I know it's there in the Old Testament. I have been trying to talk out of prophetic theology because that's what Walter Pilgrim said he'd pay me to do. But, you know, there is a lot of royal theology in the Old Testament, which is good theology in good faith, that really believes the shape of God's world is the city. And I've come out heavily on one side, but I believe our task really is to engage our people in the tension between those theologies. You know, Solomon is a man that completely lived by technical reason. Nobody ever had the world as well organized as he did. And he is a bearer of God's promises, so it's, you know, it's all mixed up. And to help people see that these texts that fight each other really are a way that we can have our existence illuminated. Seemed to me an enormous gift and work for an exegete. Well, I want to be very dialectical about civil religion.
Well, look up. All right. Question. In the face of a church that is management-oriented, in the face of a city that is management-oriented, in the face of a whole society that is management-oriented, what in hell do we do with the terror when we attack it?
Any other question?
Didn't Christ say something about a cross to carry?
Yeah, you know, it finally leads to the cross. I think that, you know, Jesus articulated and embodied an alternative righteousness that did not fit the righteousness of the management consultants. That's who the Pharisees were. They were managers of morality.
Well, I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
But so are we.
And I don't, you know, I don't have anything to say to Lutherans about the freedom of the pulpit. It's terribly important that somehow, as professionals, we help people understand they don't have any quarrels with us. They just got quarrels with the gospel. Hey, I'm not saying anything to you you don't know. I don't have any answer to your question.
I don't either. That's what's bugging me.
Say, Walt, what I've been hearing you say, and I think it's relevant maybe to Les's question, what I've been hearing you say in many different ways is that I think we have to identify the demonic element in all institutions, including the church, and yet without abdicating institutions or becoming anti-institutional, as if disestablishmentarianism is the answer.
Right. And I may have sometimes been tilted so far that it sounded to you like I was urging disestablishmentarianism, and I haven't meant that.
No,
I don't think I'm that romantic.
That hasn't come through.
Again, we really need to have Professor Tillichy talk about this, because the second question he answered this morning was sort of beginning to talk about how you get resources to do that.
I know.
Again, we really need to have Professor Tillichy talk about this, because the second question he answered this morning was sort of beginning to talk about how you get resources to do that.
I know.
And I certainly haven't been there.
May I break in at this moment then to say that you can address questions to either Dr. Brigerman or Professor Tillichy. We're not necessarily going to take you off the hook, Walt, which really we could go on a long time, but let's open it up to both and see where we go from there.
I don't sound too chaotic in my archaic thinking.
No.
I'd sure like to know what these two gentlemen see as far as the church is concerned, is relevant to faith, what the tenor is. I appreciated the Dr. Norton this morning talking about the evangelism, and I don't know, this is not going to come out okay, right, but I'll do the best I can. Having been in the same parish for about 20 years in Seattle, I've seen us go from extreme piety, where we were really building churches every week, throwing in our money into every community. And then in the late 60s, we quit building churches and started to support our government agencies and going on a fantastic social welfare kick. We quit building churches. We quit talking about being saved and salvation. Then the Pentecostals and the Baptists took over. And where are we at now, and where are we going to be down the road? Do I make sense? Besides the conversation.
This reminds me of the night in the theater when this very experienced actress was on stage with this new boy that would have his first big part. And he was relying on her very much. And at one moment, at one very dramatic moment in the play, the sound effect man made a mistake and the phone rang by mistake. And he panicked. And then he heaved a sigh of relief when he saw this very experienced actress walk over and pick up the phone, and she picked it up and she said, "Hello, it's for you."
Yeah.
My judgment is, this may be of no help at all, so you keep coming at it, and we'll finally shift it over here where you can get an answer. But the questions are so deep and so urgent in Western society that the issue is not really whether the institutional church will survive or what we ought to be doing or what we're going to be doing a decade from now. But the real issue is whether any human vision can survive in a world which is really organized on technical grounds against it. And what I think about me and most of the clergy whom I know, who are not Lutherans, they are a few Presbyterians, but in my tradition, we are so trained and in every way have our reality defined ecclesiastically that we find it difficult to take ourselves seriously, that we seriously have a major role in the survival of a human vision. Now I understand that that's a very problematic agenda when we're really worried about declining budget and declining membership and, you know, and all those urgent things that get bread on our tables. But I think that is the question before us. I suppose it is no less than the question about whether the gospel finally is true. Or have we reached a time when the demonic powers have really gotten their thing together so much that the vision we confess to be true will not prevail? You know, I think those are questions that we have to be talking about. Now, I don't know whether I've said anything in relationship to the issue you've raised.
We then look to the promises as Israel, prior to, as they were at the banks of the Jordan, they were to look to the past to see what God has done. Now therefore go, the land is yours. Is this what we should be doing? Claiming some of these promises that God has done instead of sitting in our opulent chairs arguing about how many angels can dance on a pin?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the frame in which our response has to be made. Now, the problem is, if I say yes to that, one of you is going to say, well, what in the world does that mean practically? And I don't know what that means practically, but yes. What promises?
Maybe that's a mute question.
Well, the central promise of the Old Testament is land.
But we're in the New Testament.
Oh.
I'm trying to put this deal on the boundaries for us. We get back to our parishes.
Whatever shape the land promise takes in the New Testament, and I do not believe the promises of the New Testament are different. They are to be located somewhere between Friday and Sunday. Somewhere between crucifixion and resurrection. And the question for me as a believer and for my church and for my seminary are, what kind of deaths am I called to in order that life may come? And that's something I don't want to think about. You know, and part of it I don't want to think about because I don't know how. And partly I don't want to think about it because I do know how. Well, I've been studying the land theme a great deal, and I have the impression in both Testaments that it's very dialectical, and that the gospel is a promise to people who don't have turf that it's going to be granted to them. And it is a word to people who have turf that they're about to lose it.
Talk about turf in terms of relationship.
Relationship, power, influence, security, meaning.
If that's true, we're in an awful lot of trouble.
I think that's what we're feeling among us.
You said something about whether, you know, whether the gospel is true. I'd like to ask Dr. Tivikit, whether does the church, you know, in America or in the world today, have to go through perhaps what Germany did in order to reach those truths of the gospel? Or, you know, are we really working with them as we ought in this present day?
Ob die Kirche in Amerika das durchzumachen hat, um die Wahrheit des Evangeliums kennenzulernen, was die deutsche Kirche durchmachen musste, um zu ihrer eigenen Wahrheit zu kommen. Sie ist ja gar nicht zu ihrer Wahrheit gekommen.
Well, the German church didn't really find the truth. And you are implying.
Not lehrt nicht nur beten, sondern auch fluchen.
The need or the necessity, it does not only teach us to pray, but also to curse.
Ich habe viele, auch viele Pfarrer kennengelernt, die schwerstes im Kriege durchgemacht hatten.
I have known many ministers who have experienced very bad things in the war.
So dass man meinte, wenn sie zurückkehren, werden sie völlig neu predigen.
So we thought that when they would return, they would preach in a very new way.
Sie taten es nicht.
But they didn't.
Wenn sie von ihren Kriegserlebnissen sprachen, war es überaus spannend.
They could talk in a very scintillating way when they talked about their experiences in the war.
Sobald sie die Kanzel betraten, war die alte Blässe da.
But as soon as they entered the pulpit, their talk became shallow.
Und so ist es auch mit der gesamten Kirche.
And so it was the church as a whole.
Die Not, als die Katastrophen und die Grenzsituationen als solche führen nicht zu Gott.
The borderline situations and also crises in life do not lead us necessarily to Christ.
Auch der Wohlstand tut es nicht.
Also our welfare society will not be able to do that.
Die Situationen, positiv oder negativ, sind gleich weit von Gott entfernt. Es liegt alles an der Berufung.
The situations, no matter whether we are close to God or far away from God, will not be the determining factor, but rather it depends upon whether you are called or not.
Whether you are called?
You are called, yes, as a minister. If you are called to preach the right word or not.
Well, could I ask the question or summarize?
Before you do that, let's see whether anybody wants to come back to Professor Tilicki to follow that up.
Right. Aren't circumstances, though, a means by which God issues his call and that continually validates it?
The Umstände. Gut oder schlecht, wie du auch gesagt hast, ob die Umstände nicht diejenigen sind, durch die Gott sich die Menschen offenbart und ihn beruft.
Sicher, das will ich nicht bestreiten.
Ja, certainly, I don't want to deny that.
Ich möchte nur zum Ausdruck bringen, dass es keine erkennbare Methode gibt, um den Weg zu Gott zu finden. Und deswegen auch keine bestimmten Schicksalsformen sozusagen religiös fruchtbarer sind als andere.
I only want to say that there are no certain methods by means of which we can find the way to God, so that we could, for example, attempt to live through certain crises or certain fruitful experiences which could guarantee us the way to come to God.
Gott kann Grenzsituationen, Katastrophen, apokalyptische Zeiten benutzen, um die Menschen zu sich zu rufen oder auch um sie zu verstocken.
God can use the borderline situations, crises, apocalyptical situations in, to call man to him or also to harden their hearts.
Wie ist gerade im Dritten Reich Hitlers aufgegangen, in welchem Maße eine solche ideologische Tyrannis die Menschen auch verschließen, geradezu betrunken machen und einer Hypnose aussetzen kann.
I have experienced how precisely the ideology of the Third Reich was has made it possible to close up certain men, to make them drunk and to so to say exert them to a hypnosis and not to bring them any closer to God.
It's frightening then to me to think of God as choosing, it's sort of, then I'm stuck now with a notion of God as over, as out there, acting in a capricious way against his creation, choosing on the one hand to harden and on the other hand to call. Help me with this.
Ihn schreckt dieses Bild von Gott, der völlig unberechenbar einen verschließt und den anderen öffnet. Und so ein Gott mag er, an so einen Gott mag er nicht denken.
Das wäre auch ganz falsch, an ihn zu denken.
It would be a mistake to think of God in this way.
Selbst die Calvins Prädestinationslehre darf man nicht so verstehen.
Also Calvin's doctrine of predestination we must not understand in the way in which you indicate.
Auch da ist Gott ja in keiner Weise ein blinder Wille.
Also here, God, also in Calvin's teaching of predestination, God's will is not blind and capricious.
Wenn er nur ein blinder Wille wäre, dann müsste Calvins Institutio beginnen mit der Prädestinationslehre.
If God's will would be capricious there, then Calvin's institutions would begin with the teaching of the predestination.
Da müsste am Anfang der Welt die Bestimmung zur Seligkeit oder zur Verdammung stehen und alles andere wäre nur noch eine Ausführungsform.
If that were the case, then the creation of the world would start off with salvation or damnation and all of the rest of the story of the world would merely be an execution of that first separation.
Calvins Prädestinationslehre steht aber charakteristisch nicht am Anfang, sondern innerhalb seiner Lehre von der Kirche.
But Calvin's doctrine of predestination does not characteristically stand at the beginning of the institutions, but rather in the context of the ecclesiology.
Und es ist ja auch sehr charakteristisch, wo sie bei Paulus auftaucht.
And it is also rather characteristic where it appears in Paul.
Römer 9 bis 11.
In Romans 9 to 11.
Und Luther hat dazu eine sehr interessante Erklärung gegeben.
Luther has given, has added a very interesting explanation for this.
Er hat gesagt, die Architektur des Römerbriefes ist selbst schon eine Lehre des Evangeliums.
He said, already the architecture of the letters to the Romans is already a proclamation of the world.
Römer 1 bis 8 wird das allein aus Gnaden beschrieben.
In Romans 1 to 8 we hear Luther said the sola gratia alone by grace.
Und nun entsteht für den, der sich allein aus Gnaden berufen weiß, eine bestimmte schwere Frage.
And now, for him who is called alone by grace, a very heavy question arises.
Denn das allein aus Gnaden bedeutet ja, es gibt keinen Schlüssel, kein erkennbares Kriterium Gottes dafür, dass er Gnade zuteil werden lässt.
For being saved by grace alone implies that you don't have a key, that you don't have a recognizable criterion by means of which you can recognize God's grace.
Und darum entsteht die Frage,
Warum gerade mir?
And for that reason, the question arises, why should this grace happen to me?
In der Regel wird ja diese Frage, warum gerade mir, als Theodizee-Frage gestellt, wenn ein Unglück mir widerfährt und ich frage, warum muss mir das gerade geschehen?
Generally, the question, why does it happen to me, is raised in the context of the question of theodicy, namely in the context of an evil event that befalls me, so that I'm forced to ask, why should this evil befall me?
Es gibt eine deutsche Hymne, ich weiß nicht, ob sie in Ihrem Gesangbuch aufsteht, mir ist Erbarmung widerfahren.
There is a German hymn, I don't know whether it is present in your hymnal also, with the title, and I don't know that hymn, but the German hymn would be translated, I have experienced God's grace.
Und dann wird die Frage gestellt, woher dies kam, warum geschieht? Also warum ist mir diese Erbarmung widerfahren?
And then the question is raised in the hymn, why has this grace happened to me?
Und dann wird die Antwort gegeben, Erbarmung ist und weiter nichts.
And then the hymn continues and says, it is God's grace and nothing else.
Logisch gesehen ist das eine Tautologie.
Logically, this is tautological.
Also mit anderen Worten, ich kann nur die Erbarmung Gottes als das letzte Geheimnis seiner Gnade verehren.
In other words, I can adore God's grace towards me only as his last, the last and unfathomable secret of his being.
Und darum warnt Luther bei der Einleitung zum Römerbrief davor, die Prädestinationslehre in falscher Form zu stellen.
And for that reason, Luther warns in the introduction to the letter to the Romans that we should not use the doctrine of predestination in the wrong way.
Wenn man sie als erstes stellt, wird es eine falsche philosophische Spekulation, sodass man Prädestination dann besser als Determination bezeichnen müsste.
If we place it first, we treat predestination as a false philosophical a speculation which implies that we use it as an ideology. We use it as a determination and not predestination.
Und dann wird man, deswegen darf man die Prädestinationsfrage erst stellen an dem Punkt, wo man bei Römer 9 angekommen ist.
And for that reason, we must ask for the predestination only at the point of Romans 9.
Erst wenn man am Herzen Gottes geborgen ist, fragt man zurück, wie bin ich dahin gekommen?
Only when we have come to the heart of God, when we have arrived there, then we can ask, how did I get there?
Und deswegen kommt das schöne Wort, dieser schöne Wort da, jede Lehre hat ihre Zeit, ihr Alter und ihre Stunde.
And for that reason, at that place, Luther says, every doctrine has its place, each time and its hour.
Jede Lehre und jede Wahrheit ist an bestimmte Existenzsituationen gebunden.
Every doctrine and every truth is tied to a very special existential situation.
Und nur dann kann man das Thema Prädestinationslehre anschneiden.
And only at that time is it possible to raise the topic of predestination.
Und dann ist Gott nicht mehr der schreckensvoll beliebig erwählen und verwerfen.
And only then, when we have done so, is it possible to see God no longer as the one who capriciously rejects, but rather as the one who graciously selects.
Now I throw at you the thought that your exegesis of Deuteronomy and your use of the Exodus, the Moses story, gives, I see, gives me some tools to see in other parts of the Bible, not only in the New Testament, but in all the other parts, the grand story, the grand plan, and also a way to evaluate where we are as we were asking, what are we going to do about the social ministry, these other things. I see this as a way of standing just back a step and taking a look and then wading in.
Moltmann recently has been in very many places saying that the church must always ask about its identity and about its relevance, by which he means mission. And he says, which I'm sure we're kind of all aware of, that in the last decade, the relevance question was so urgent that it caused us to neglect the identity question. Now, I have no doubt that very soon we will say we have been so preoccupied with the identity question we will ask the relevance question.
Right on.
But the identity question, as I think Moltmann means it, can only be answered by our regular and repeated telling of the primal story.
Right.
And what you're saying is that the primal story may be a more extended and inclusive story than we have allowed by focusing too narrowly on a single piece of the story.
Yeah, this is what I've gained from it so far.
Yeah. There is, as you know, a growing literature about the urgency of storytelling for the doing of theology. A lot of that is silly, but some of it is very important. And in terms of that repeated telling of the story, Margaret Mead recently has written that the problem with liturgy and ritual and storytelling is that we live in a culture which is bored if you do the same thing once. And we are committed, centrally in the Eucharist, but all over we are committed to telling the same story. I'll give you a little book on that by John Westerhoff. It's entitled Generation to Generation. And it's a very suggestive study about the telling of the story as the focus for the life of the whole congregation.
Walt, I'm concerned about technology within the church. Would you care to comment where Lyle Schaller is taking us?
Mm. I've read a little bit of his, but I really haven't read a lot. Do you want?
Is he an agent of Pharaoh?
Well, you want to identify a little bit more about?
Okay, I'm just
get our adrenaline flowing.
Organization, planning. John Kenneth Galbraith has a very simple definition of what technology is, and that is organization, planning, corporate management, which seeks to set and organize the fixtures of where we're going and what we're doing. And in my own particular struggle, it concerns the setting of goals and evaluating them and then setting another set of goals.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not sure if it's a game or whether we're using it as a tool whereby we become effective.
Yeah. My impression, not talking about Schaller, but the United Church of Christ, which is my church more than any other church, I suspect, is controlled by management-type people. And I think I or anyone would be a fool who says we don't need that kind of work in the church. But at least in our church, the people who have competence and expertise in that field are theologically illiterate